Hello all, Tamara Carroll, Director of Community Engagement for Profile Theater here. Before we get started with today's podcast, I want to let y'all know about a special event happening Monday, August 5th. Profile Theater and Advanced Gender Equity in the Arts is co-hosting a one-night-only reading of Beheading Columbus by playwright Diana Burbano, directed by Melissa Crespo. Diana Burbano is a recipient of Age's Legacy Grant, and Beheading Columbus is the story of two sisters who go down a road of DNA testing that reveals truths about their genetic makeup that they would rather not confront. This one-time staged reading of Beheading Columbus is free and performs on Monday, August 5th, 7 p.m. at Imago Theater. For tickets, visit profiletheater.org. And now, on with our regularly scheduled program. Hello all, and welcome to Satellite, Profile Theater's podcast that deepens our audience's connection to the work itself, the process of creating the work, and the artists doing the work. I'm Tamara Carroll, Profile Theater's Director of Community Engagement, bringing you our third and final episode orbiting our upcoming production of Reggie Hoops, written by Christopher Diaz and directed by Melissa Crespo. Today's guest was a real treat to have the opportunity to interview. Wesley Tipton served as dramaturg on Reggie Hoops, bringing a ton of imagery and information to help contextualize the show for the actors and creative team, and also for our audiences. Her work was a huge contribution to the lobby display that folks will see as they are going into the theater. Wesley is a junior at Syracuse University studying theater management, writing, and dramaturgy, and Profile had the opportunity to work with Wesley because of the partnership between Syracuse University and Syracuse Stage, where, of course, Reggie Hoops director Melissa Crespo is the associate artistic director and is currently mentoring Wesley in artistic direction. After talking to Wesley, I felt ever so slightly less cynical about the future of American theater. So here is hoping that it does the same for you. Welcome, everyone. I am joined not in the basement of Imago, nor in the office of Imago, where I typically have these interviews. But we are, in fact, joined remotely from all the way, I assume in New York, definitely the East Coast, by Wesley. Is it Tipton?
Yeah, Tipton. And I'm actually coming to you from Maryland.
Maryland. Okay.
Yeah.
Is that where you, so you're a student, yes?
Yes.
So is that where you are summering? Are you summering in Maryland? Is that where your family is?
Yeah, I've been living in Maryland since I was, I think, like 7, so second grade. But I've bopped all around the U.S. I was born in Las Vegas, like in a hospital right off the strip.
Nice!
Moved to Colorado. Yeah, but Maryland's the permanent home.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Great. And you... Yeah, just continue on your brief biography, the Wesley Tipton story. So moved to Maryland. You can pick up around second grade. Moved to Maryland, and now and then how did you get involved in theater? And where are you now? Not literally now, because now you're in Maryland. But like, what are you doing with your life and times?
There's never been a time when I wasn't interested in theater. It's like, I feel like it's kind of one of those things that you're born with. But I like to think that it was the first time that I saw Wicked that really did it, because it's Wicked and what are you going to do? Like, you can't help but fall in love with it.
I could help but fall in love with it, to be honest. But we'll maybe circle back to that. Maybe you can make a convert out of me.
Noted. But like, for my 4-year-old self, like, all I'd seen was I was a big movie kid and I had a little DVD player in the car. So seeing something like right in front of me, that was crazy for me. And just all the gorgeous songs and the effects, it was a lot for my 4-year-old self. And my mom likes to say that I didn't even move during intermission. I was just like glued to the stage. And so that was my first major theater experience. But then I did the standard theater kid, middle school, high school, like performances. And then it was COVID, and I kind of learned that I preferred behind the scenes stuff. I like making things happen. I like improving on things. And our theater department was struggling because we were on COVID and everything was on Zoom. And I was like, hey, I think I can make this better. So I made an arts chair position in our student government. And that kind of led me down more of a theater management route. And then I ended up at Syracuse University pursuing theater management. So it all led me there.
Amazing. Yeah, I should say I had graduated college when I saw Wicked, and I really loved the book, which when you were four, you probably hadn't read. And I was not very like a very musical theater person at that time. I've like come around to be more open, so maybe I should give Wicked another chance. Definitely, though, it is like spectacle forward and would blow a kid's mind for sure. So I didn't really think so. You were in high school during the pandemic. What year did you graduate, if you don't mind my asking?
Yeah, I graduated in 2021 from high school. And so I think it was early in my junior year that we went in lockdown, and we had just figured out that we were doing Into the Woods and done casting, and I had gotten the witch, and it was like the biggest thing ever. I was like crying about it, and then COVID, and I was like, this is so devastating. But had to make do with moving online, and that's just the way.
That is, you were robbed. Yeah, I will also say Into the Woods, the musical that turned me on to musical theater, I think. I mean, it was like In the Heights and Hamilton, but then I became like a big Sondheim person. I was gonna say Sondheim head. I don't think that's a thing, but
You can make it a
I
thing.
can make it a thing. I feel like, yeah, I did the thing where like I discovered Sondheim quite late in life, and it was like getting chicken pox late in life. It was just like absolutely terrible, in the best way. Yeah, that is so that's quite a thing. All right, so theater management. Tell me a little bit about like your program. Well, tell me about Syracuse. As like a I don't know Syracuse at all. Upstate New York. So yeah, tell me about your school. Tell me about the place where you are learning.
So I'll preface with the fact that I went to a super tiny it was for it, my school in Maryland was from pre-K through 12th grade. I wasn't there that whole time, but it was still pretty tiny, and I graduated with a class of like 20 people. And I was, yeah. So at that point, I was like, I need something bigger. And that feels like like the image of college that I had in my mind, whether that's true or not. And so I ended up at Syracuse, which has, I think, around 15,000 students.
Oh my
So
gosh.
bit of a jump. It's a cold place. You're freezing from November until the end, but that's all right. But yeah, I really chose Syracuse because it has an amazing theater department. And I don't know how many drama departments have theater management majors, but I applied to both Syracuse University and Ithaca because they have a pretty similar program. But I ended up going with Syracuse because they have this great partnership between Syracuse Stage, which is the regional theater in Syracuse, and SU Drama. So we're all in one building. Sometimes we get taught by Syracuse Stage like employees. You get to work on Syracuse Stage shows. So it was this really beautiful partnership that not many schools have, that was really engaging and exciting, and it's helped me find a lot of, you know, different opportunities in school that I don't think I would have found otherwise. But other than that, it's just a really communal environment for making theater, and the campus kind of reminded me of something like Hogwarts, which was what my soul wanted at the time. So yeah.
That makes sense. It's a much smaller college, but I went to Reed in Portland, which I think has that similar sort of brick building, old world feel. Not really like a castle, but I think I know what you mean. And that partnership between Syracuse Stage and Syracuse University, I think, is how you kind of found your way onto this project, because you were working in some capacity that Melissa Crespo knew you, who's, of course, the associate artistic director at Syracuse and directed Reggie Hoops. So how did it come to be that you found your way to this project in Portland, Oregon, on the other side of the world? Nope, the other side of the country.
Yeah. So as a theater management student, you have a lot of opportunities to take on internships through Syracuse Stage. So at one point I had a marketing and PR internship within Syracuse Stage's marketing department. But then last semester I got the artistic direction kind of internship, and that one was with Melissa, and she was my mentor, my internship head that whole time, and we really hit it off. And before that, I had worked as the dramaturg for our SU Drama production of Dance Nation, I think my sophomore year. And then this past semester, I worked on Syracuse Stage's production of Murder on the Orient Express as a dramaturg. So Melissa really knew that I loved dramaturgy and that I doing my best to explore it in any capacity. And a lot of the projects she ended up handing over to me were like mini research projects. And then as the internship went on, I started to hear about this show that she's working on, Reggie Hoops. And she ended up coming to me and being like, hey, I need help researching this. Would you be willing to help? And slowly that morphed into me being dramaturg for the show. So it was just kind of a spiral effect, and the position just kept growing. And I'm so grateful to Melissa for, you know, accounting for my passions and what I was really wanting to do, and extending my internship to this huge summer project that's been super, super fulfilling.
Yeah, well, as a director myself, it is a luxury to get to work with a dramaturg. I'm sure that when she, you know, found someone who was capable and that she liked working with, she was like, yes, come do all the things with with me. So that's a great segue to talking about Reggie Hoops a little bit. First, for folks in our audience who may not know or just may want to, you know, have another explanation or definition, like, how would you, when you're at a cocktail party and someone's like, well, so what is a dramaturg? What does a dramaturg do? How do you lay it out for them?
Yeah, it's a bit of a complicated role, and I honestly had no clue what it was until I came to school. So I think it's one of those positions that you kind of just encounter and then you slowly learn what it is. But for me, I would say that the role of a dramaturg really varies based on the type of text that you're working with, first of all, and then the director's needs. But they're really there to help contextualize a production and provide super specific insight where others might not have the same knowledge or time to dive into more complicated topics in a piece. So within like a classical text, for instance, they might help decipher the complexities of like language and rhythm and the themes within a classical piece of text. But more of my work is in, thus far, is in more modern pieces. And what I do is really try to build out a play or a musical as it extends into the wider world. So looking beyond just words on a page and trying to understand the world at large. So I'll give another example. When I worked on Murder on the Orient Express, a lot of what I tried to do was like, look at Agatha Christie's life. What's she doing? And what in London in 1934 is impacting the world that she's building on this train? You know, what, we're in between World War I and World War II. What does that mean for the time period? What's happening in the places that this train is passing through that might build up all of the tensions for the performers? And then for the dramaturg, after collecting all of this type of information, you're then called upon to either present it in rehearsal or provide an actor packet or be there for all of rehearsal. It really depends at that point on what the director needs. But yeah, it's a contextualizing the wider world of a piece.
Cool. So what, how did you start looking at what needed to be contextualized for Reggie Hoops? How did you look at the script and think, what is it going to be useful for? Because it's also not just the actors or the director, right? Like the entire creative team, costume designer, sound designer, you know, can all benefit from someone contributing to the research about the wider world that the play takes place in. So when you looked at Reggie Hoops, what were some of the things that popped out to you that you were like, these are going to be useful areas to explore for the production to have a better understanding of the world around it?
Yeah. So what I first did with Reggie Hoops was build a timeline, because as I was reading it, I kind of realized that since the piece jumps back and forth between 1970s Bronx, New York City, and then 2016, there's a lot of history to unpack there. And I realized I didn't know where to place myself within any of that. And that's how I kind of like to start my dramaturgical work, is like, what do I need to understand the piece? Because normally that's what everyone needs to understand a piece and to approach it. So that's where I started, and then kind of picked through the rest of the script to figure out, okay, what are the big points in the play that are super impactful, both within the piece and in the actual world at the time? So most of that turned out to be like the New York City-wide blackout in 1977, or the Francis Tavern blast, the birth of hip-hop, which is in 1973, you know, all of these super big events that help place us in time. And getting all of those on the timeline first, I think was my first goal, and then branching off from there.
Do you have any examples of the way that you have seen, either on Reggie Hoops or just in general, the context that you've brought into rehearsal through that research find its way into the work of the actors or the creative team?
Yes, yeah, sadly, I haven't been able to be at rehearsals all that much since I'm on Zoom. But one of the points that I think became super helpful and was actually surprising was Chris asked me to dive into the theme of sacrifice, and which is, it's a theme that runs throughout the entire piece. You know, Reggie talks about it, her dad talks about it, sacrifice is always brought up, and we kind of wanted to dig into this theme because we figured it would be a helpful point for Reggie and that character to dive into. And so I did some digging into like sacrifice and sport and what athletes have to say about it. And at some point it was hard to piece together some of the information, but after doing some digging, you know, I found a bunch of things about how like the quote unquote greats are really, they really hone in on sacrifice as like the biggest and most important part of the game. And I think that as a point for the character of Reggie was really helpful to like note that that's a real thing that these super successful athletes think and draw from, because I think it helps ground the character and make sure that we're, you know, we're actually pulling from people's experiences, which is super cool.
Yeah, it's not just something that the playwright decided they want to write a play, or that they've like have a plot point that pivots on the idea that sacrifice is important. It's like, no, this is grounded in this world of like the sports world, and would definitely be something that both Reggie and her father would have, based on their like intense interest in sports, would have like absorbed and would have like taken on as a personal philosophy. Yeah, that's I did not even know that that was a thing. That's very cool.
Yeah, it's super, super interesting.
Was there anything else that you discovered during research, like doing research for the show? Was there anything else you discovered doing research for the show that was like surprising or unexpected or that you hadn't known about at all?
Honestly, so much of it was surprising. The amount of history packed into this one play is insane. It's so deep, and I caught myself falling down rabbit holes so often because there's so many bits and pieces. But I'll share a couple of examples that I found super, super interesting. First of all, there was this thing going around New York City around 1975 that really changed kind of people's perspective on living in New York City. And there were tons of layoffs to like police and sanitation workers, teachers, social workers, basically everyone is getting laid off. There's huge budget cuts. There's bankruptcy. And I found this thing called the New York City Fear City Packet. And it was actually written by a bunch of people from the NYPD who had recently been laid off or felt that they had much less influence. And they basically made a packet that was like a how to survive New York City in 1975, considering like everything that was happening. So it was like, don't leave valuables in your car, don't walk at night or at all. And all these kind of intense like steps you need to take to be safe in New York City. And it's a completely real packet that we were able to sift through during the process. And it was super interesting to like listen to all of the performers' reactions to reading it, because, you know, this is a thing that was actually happening. So that was super, super interesting. And then the other stuff that jumped out to me was a lot of the modern statistics about particularly women of color within higher level basketball positions. So Reggie, for instance, was a scout for the Brooklyn Nets, but she was fired. But knowing this and looking at like the history of at least female basketball scouts, there's only one so far in history, and that's Bonnie Jill Laughlin. And just thinking about the fact that there's only one other female basketball scout compared to Reggie, like that is an insane and powerful thing that shows how good Reggie is at her job and like how impressive it is that she got this role. And also the amount that basketball and leadership has to grow and change still, because that's how it is today. So that was absolutely interesting to figure out.
That's bonkers. I mean, I definitely would imagine, you know, and the play kind of makes it clear, and you know, it doesn't seem implausible that, like, it's incredibly rare, doesn't seem implausible that it's incredibly rare for a woman, and especially a woman of color, and especially a queer woman of color, to be, like, very underrepresented in those circles, but to think, like, in this world that Chris has made, which is, like, a parallel of reality, like, Reggie might be the only one, or, like, one of two. That's,
yeah,
really intense.
Yeah, absolutely. It was interesting to find that out and see the layers built into that, for sure.
Yeah, well, I am super grateful for your research. Audiences, I think, also really benefit from having that kind of context. And we are going to be featuring quite a lot of Wesley's research in the lobby so that folks coming to see the show can see, you know, how underrepresented women, and especially women of color in basketball, are in the NBA specifically, and get some visual imagery of the Bronx and New York City during this time of, like, intense economic depression or recession, and the, you know, crime waves and so forth, or, like, the fear of crime that you're talking about. So thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for, you know, helping make that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Makes my job. It helps me with my job. It's a beautiful collaboration. I want to spend just a moment before we let you go, pulling back out to sort of the broader picture of theater, because I don't get to talk to folks who are, so I work with middle and high school students, theater students a lot, who maybe or maybe not, like, may not be actually thinking about pursuing it as a career. And if they are, just, like, don't have experience in the industry. So I don't get to talk to, you know, folks who are really in the moment of trying to determine what they, you know, what they want their impact on the field to look like, or are getting acquainted maybe with the field. So I'm curious, what are you excited to sort of get out and apply your skills to, what you've been learning in the future?
Yeah. Big question.
I know. What do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah, it changes so often, but I am happy to say that dramaturgy is one of those things that stuck around and it won't leave me alone, which I love. And it's a complicated relationship because it nags at me, but that's okay.
Mm-hmm. All the best ones do.
They do. But I mean, I would love to continue pursuing dramaturgy in the future. As a dramaturg, I think that it's particularly important to see the totality of storytelling and not just look at your standard sources or at one person's perspective about history, which is so often, you know, a very whitewashed perspective of history, a very male perspective of history. And I think that it's important as a dramaturg to bring to every rehearsal room the true fact that history is not one-sided and there are so many branches and people. And I think that's my goal with dramaturgy moving forward, is to make that clear and to ensure that with every space that I go into, I'm not bringing one perspective there, and that I'm not the only person providing, like, I don't need everything to come from me. I would rather have, you know, a video from a primary source where that person living in that time is talking about their experience. You know, I don't want dramaturgy to just be a thing that's about me or that needs to necessarily come from me. But I want to make sure that I'm providing a wide array of resources from many perspectives so that we have this continued understanding that history and the world is not something basic, and that there's no, like, quote-unquote normal way to look at history. So that's how I'd like to continue to push into that field specifically.
Yeah, that makes me think about, you know, when we're trying to provide materials for a play, we're trying to contextualize a play, support with research, you know, usually there is a point of view that the play may be putting forth, and you want to find what supports that, but you also want to find what complicates that and pushes against that and adds dimension to that. I think what I was thinking about when you were saying that was, you know, you and I were doing some similar research as I was thinking about the lobby display, and one of the things that I wanted to demonstrate or, like, sort of show audiences visually was the difference between the Bronx and Scarsdale, right? Just like when Ben and Iz take their family out of the Bronx and move them to Scarsdale, like, what does that mean for how it changes the environment in which Reggie and Muncie, their kids, grow up? And what does that mean? Yeah, just what does that mean for the environment in which they grow up? And how does that offer them some opportunities? But also, you know, it's a very different racial demographic. It's a very different, et cetera, right? And as I was sort of starting to put together pictures, I was just really aware of, I've only got so much time, I've only got so much space, and the main thing I, like, feel like I want to communicate is, like, the Bronx was going through this recession, and there had been all these fires, and there was all this, like, property damage, and it was just a really, there's a population density, there's just, like, you know, so many people, like, living close together, and so much, et cetera, et cetera. And, like, then you've got this very wealthy suburb, that's very, like, clean, maybe, and, you know, like, kept in really good, you know, extremely high median income compared to the rest of the country and certainly compared to the Bronx. And at one point I just, like, paused and I was like, I am basically just telling, like, this is, like, a story that's, like, Bronx, bad, Scarsdale, good, not, you know, like, that is the way that it could be interpreted, right?
Absolutely. No, I mean, I totally understand what you're saying, and I think that they mention this a lot in the play. There's actually a quote that I'll read from the piece.
Oh, beautiful.
It says, this is when Bells is talking about, talking to Reggie's mom about the time period and living in the Bronx. And she says, all kinds of revolutionaries, self-proclaimed and others who took tiny, tangible action to make it through the nightmares. And I think that it's really interesting to see New York City in the 70s from multiple angles, because at some points people see protests and people, you know, fighting for what they believe in as riots and as being, you know, super violent. And in some cases they were, but you have to look at, you know, what necessitates rebellion and how does, like, structural racism and scapegoating and, like, we're on the back end of the civil rights movement. How are all of these things coming together and converging in this one place? And what does it mean to have all of these different perspectives and the need to change your situation or to, live in very difficult times that are, like, forcing marginalized communities into rebellion? So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a incredibly complex time, and looking at all of the different sides is the only way to fully understand everything while not pinning the two against each other.
Totally. And I mean, just as you're saying that, it reminds me of like the way that Ben, right, Reggie and Muncie's dad is like, does regard leaving the Bronx to go to Scarsdale, not just as like getting out or moving up, but like does regard it in a way as sacrifice, right? Because yep. you do have, I think, you know, somewhere I read that the Bronx is considered one of the most diverse places, maybe in the United States. It's like an incredibly diverse place. It's incredibly like, you know, like birth of hip hop. There's all of this artistic and creative social energy that you move to a place like Scarsdale and you've given your kids some incredible opportunities by like putting them in you know, probably schools that are better resourced, etc. But you've also deprived them of some really just like incredible opportunities that they wouldn't, or experiences that they wouldn't be able to get anywhere else. So that's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, hip hop was born then, salsa and punk rock. I mean, it's a time of community and creation as well as a difficult time.
Because mm-hmm. it was such a difficult time.
Yeah.
So well, we veered back into the show a little bit. I'm curious, which is great. That was great. I'm curious, thinking about your focus in theater management, as you are probably aware, you know, theater took a big hit during the pandemic, and things have been, audiences, at least in Portland, and I think this is probably true across the country, I'm seeing like theaters struggling. Audiences didn't fully come back in the same numbers. The model that a lot of regional theaters have used, the sort of subscriber model, where people say, you know, here's money, I'm going to come to the whole season, and it gives the theater an influx of like cash flow early on so that they can sort of plan how much, you know, they can have like a reservoir that they can count on. That model seems to be possibly fading away. Yeah, and so I'm curious how folks who, and there's what you just referenced a moment ago, right? Like there's a whole new attentiveness to the need to disrupt some of the inherent, the sort of single lens that folks have been viewing theater through. And the power structures of theater. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean. I'm curious about how, like, you and your colleagues who are getting ready to enter into this field are thinking about what you're inheriting, what you all, like, how you all talk about the state of the field, the industry, and what y'all are excited to see to make happen, or what do you see the challenges as?
Jeez, the thing about being in a drama department and around so many young people who are so excited about theater, but also see the world from, you know, a younger perspective, is that everyone is really aiming for growth and change within theater, within the theater world, which I think is incredibly exciting. And the thing that keeps me looking forward to leaving school and to entering the wider field, and there's some lasting fear there left over from COVID and from, you know, super high ticket prices and, you know, having trouble just seeing theater. But it's these colleagues of mine who keep me excited about theater and wanting to pursue it and knowing that it can continue to change and grow. I mean, I have some friends in school who, like, all that they want to do is go into community engagement and getting young people excited about theater, because that is the most important thing to making sure that people feel like they belong in a theater and seeing art, because it can be so exclusionary when you go to New York City and you try to see like a Broadway show and it's $300. You know, that's not accessible. That's not something that everyone can do. So I really think that it's these people who are reaching out to young people today, and kids who really get it and who inspire me to like see the next generation of theater goers. And seeing young people get excited about theater makes me so excited about theater. I'm also super excited that we're thinking more about accessibility in theater, not only on like social media, but also on stage. Like we just had How to Dance in Ohio, a show with autistic actors on stage. And that actually started, they had one of their runs at Syracuse Stage, which is amazing. And it's so cool to like see all these people around me so passionate about seeing change and growth in theater and not telling the same stories that we've told for such a long time. So it's a lot of things that get me excited about theater. And I don't know, I'm ready to just get out there and make change happen, you know?
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. I think accessibility is going to be, I hope is going to be the next place, the next like widespread awakening, and that we're going to start really putting our attention on it. And when we do, there's going to be such a creative boom that comes out of that. Like it's going to
be,
it's going to be freaking cool is what it's going to be.
Yeah. That's the amazing thing is like when there's a little spark of change, there's so many more people who can get involved in theater and who are like, oh my gosh, my story now matters in this world. Like that is so important to telling stories. And that's what we're in the business in, you know, in the end. And I think that we just need to make sure that we're focusing on people and on connecting with people and telling stories that matter to everyone, not just, you know, putting butts in seats, though that's necessary. I want to make sure that we can have both.
Yeah. Well, that when there's more people who feel that the story is relevant to them, they're more likely to bring their butt to the seat, I think, is the hope.
Yes. Get your butt in the seat.
Get your butt in the seat. Or on the stage.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
Get your butt on the stage. Okay, awesome. Final question, stolen from the Ezra Klein Show. What is one book, or he just says book. He just says, what are three books that you recommend? I'm going to broaden that because not everybody's into books. One book, article, play, someone's work that you think is fascinating or change the way you think about making theater. What's a text or media source that inspired you and why?
Yeah, there are so many, but I actually studied abroad in London my last fall semester, and I saw The Ocean at the End of the Lane by Neil Gaiman. It's also a book, but it was turned into a play. And that was the first time in, I would say, like my adult experience that I felt like true and utter shock just seeing like gorgeous, gorgeous things on stage. And then it made me sob for like 10 minutes afterwards. So that's always a good crowd pleaser. But I think that shows attentiveness to like being human and the complexities of being human reminded me of like, you can tell it's a super fantastical story with like puppets and like all of this funky stuff, but then it's telling a super, super human story. And I think that that's a beautiful way to pursue creating theater, you know, something that's beautiful and seems out of this world, but that tells the most like clear and human themes. That's my favorite thing. So that's the type of theater that I would like to, one, continue doing in the US, and just make in general.
Nice. Yeah, Neil Gaiman's stuff, I can only imagine, makes for fantastical and fantastic theater. Love that. Love that stuff.
It truly does. Yeah, cool. Absolutely.
Well, Wesley, thank you so much for your time today and all your contributions to Reggie Oops. I wish you could see it.
I know.
Well, if you are ever in Portland, if you ever find yourself over here, look us up at Profile, and we'd love to see you. And good luck.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
By the time this episode is posted, you'll have an entire second weekend of shows to catch Reggie Hoops, running Thursday, August 8th through Sunday, August 11th at 7:30 p.m. with a matinee at 2 p.m. on Sunday. That matinee is being followed by a post-show mat chat, a facilitated discussion with the audience led by me. All shows are at Imago Theater, 17 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. And for tickets and more information, visit profiletheater.org. We hope to see you at the theater.